Serve It Cold, episode 15. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
The Battle of New Orleans took place on January 8, 1815, and was the final major battle of the War of 1812. American forces, under General Andrew Jackson, decisively defeated an invading British army intent on seizing New Orleans and America's western lands. The Treaty of Ghent had been signed on December 24, 1814, but news of the peace would not reach New Orleans until February. At the end of the day, the British had 2,037 casualties, 291 dead, including three senior generals, 1,262 wounded, and 484 captured or missing. The Americans had 71 casualties, 13 dead, 39 wounded, and 19 missing. Johnny C. is hiding under a dock.
Within a couple of minutes, I heard another car pulling off the highway. I didn't even think about it. I jumped up and ran into the water as fast as I could. I was under the pier again before I even looked to see what was behind me. It was Big John's truck. I came running out of the water just as fast as I went in and ran right by Big John on my way to the truck. He grabbed me and pulled me down to the ground and made me breathe a while before he let me talk. While I was breathing, he was checking out the scene. Alba's body, the beat-up pier, a thousand other details I would never notice. When I started to talk, he stopped me cold as soon as I said the word suitcase. "Creedmoor," he said. "We've got to get that suitcase now before somebody else shows up to get it." We got the suitcase, put Alba back in the water, and left. We drove into Slidell and got a room in a cheap motel to regroup. Even after a hot shower and fresh clothes, I was still cold, and sat there on the Magic Fingers bed, wrapped in a blanket. Big John came in with a 12-pack of Diet Coke and a bucket of ice, instead of the beer that I really wanted. I knew then that we weren't going home that night. I watched numbly while Big John spread out the items he had gleaned from the scene, in the time it took for me to walk the pier and come back with the suitcase. He threw a large-caliber magnum shell casing onto the spindly desk. "Your cannon," he said. He tossed me a Palm Pilot, triple A's. "See if this thing is waterlogged. You're better at this computer stuff than I am." I opened the fancy metal case and found the PDA in good shape. I turned it on, but Alba had it password protected. John looked over and said, "Try AAAX. It worked. I looked at him like he'd just broken the Enigma code. He shrugged and said, he took notes on it at our meeting. I saw him make at least a couple of A's and then that weird crossing move you guys have to do to make an X. He put down a keychain with one small key on it. He pulled the suitcase up and set it on the bed beside me. The key fit, and after carefully looking for tripwires, Big John opened the suitcase. Inside were gallon Ziploc bags full of money. John didn't look surprised in the least. I asked, "Okay, I give. What's going on?" And John said, "You're on a need-to-know basis here, Creedmoor. We'll get you a cab to take you back to Catherine, and then you're out of it." And that's when I lost it. I have no idea what I said, but I can still remember how hot my face felt while I was doing it. Big John finally said, "Okay, Vera's gonna kill me for getting you involved in this shit, but you're a big boy. I'll lay it out enough for you to make a decision, but no more than that. The one thing you already know is that we are no longer able to collect a bounty on Alphonsus Alba. The other key thing you have to know is that there is a Bayou Labatry boat standing off of Cat Island. Officially, she's up from Coatzacoalcos, shrimping in the Bay of Campeche. She's heavy, sitting low in the water, and she's been sitting out there 2 days. What does that tell you? Told me a lot. Bayou Labatry doesn't necessarily mean a boat from Bayou Labatry. It means a big shrimp boat, a 75-footer. The first big shrimpers come out of Bayou Labatry. These big boats can go a long way and carry a big load. So, why would a shrimper go all the way to the Yucatan and catch a load of jumbo white shrimp or some deep water red shrimp, then come all the way back up here and just sit for 2 days instead of running into harbor and unloading their shrimp? Because their real cargo is not the shrimp, of course. Then he told me how Alba's family controls video poker and slot machines at truck stops and dives all over Louisiana and Mississippi. They use the businesses to launder money, and they skim from the gambling receipts. And AAA was skimming from them. Alba had planned to make an early trip to the boat to do his own little business deal, and then return with the three Vinnies later for the usual buy. But AAA had a problem. He couldn't pilot a boat. That's why he called Big John up. Big John would get Alba to and from the shrimper and act as bodyguard for a big discount on the drugs he was buying. The real plan was for Big John to take Alba to get the drugs, but the boat would have engine problems on the way back, and they'd have to pull up onto the mud lump the Rigolette's lighthouse sits on. Deeg and his ex-partner would be waiting at the lighthouse to catch Alba red-handed with a load of drugs. They would explain to him the wisdom of going back to face the New Jersey court system, the DEA agent would take credit for finding the drugs, and everyone would live happily ever after. I asked him why, of all the gin joints in the world, did Alba end up dying on the one pier I was hiding under? He told me that it was the only pier he could give directions to, and that he was reasonably sure wasn't being used. So he had told Alba he would pick him up from the pier that night on the way to the shrimper. He hadn't known that AAA would want to hide the money before night. He must have known that the family was on to him. I said to him, I don't think Alba is going to make that rendezvous. Why don't we just take the suitcase full of money and hightail it to Catherine? John, it's a suitcase full of money. That would be a good plan, Creedmoor, and one I think you should follow. I've still got some business here. Deeg didn't show this afternoon. They've got him. And they're hoping that we've got the money. They'll trade Deeg for the money. I just got a call on my cell phone while I was getting the cokes. Have you thought that Deeg might have crossed you? He didn't get mad at my accusation. He turned away from me and said, Deeg and I lay in a rice paddy for 3 days one time, Creedmoor. If I can't trust him, I can't trust anyone. I asked him, proof that Deeg's alive? The fact that they have my cell phone number is all they gave me. I just said his name, and he slumped over in the chair, his hands on his face. He said, I know, it's a chump play. That's why I want you out of here, Creedmoor. You've got Vera to think about. What could I say? I pulled the other chair up to the little table, and we carefully planned the royal fuck-up, now known as the Battle of Lake Catherine. That night, we loaded two V-hull 18-foot skiffs that Big John had already painted black and parked at a fish camp right up the road here and headed out. John and the suitcase were in the first skiff. He had a single red light pointed back toward me. All I had to do was follow the bouncing ball of red. I was running dark. The sky was clear when we left out. Cool October night. It's beautiful. We shot down the Rigolets and into Lake Bourne, and we started to get a few wisps of fog. By the time we got to the rendezvous, no stars were visible and the fog was thickening. As soon as Big John's red light went out, I cut my engine off and coasted. Up ahead, I could see a big cabin cruiser, all lit up. There were a couple of lumps silhouetted on deck that I figured were Vinnie's, Our plan was simple. We would sit and watch. If Big John could see that Deeg was alive, he would make the exchange, and they would go into the water. They were both Navy SEALs, who thought of the ocean as their own backyard. If he couldn't be sure that Deeg was alive, John would leave the suitcase in the boat as bait and hit the water on his own. He would blow a hole in the cruiser's hull and kill any Vinny stupid enough to follow him into the water. Like I said, a real simple plan. My part of the plan, in fact, was simple. All I had to do was hunker down in the dark until the shooting had died down, and when John lit his green flare, I was going to zoom in and pick him and Deeg up. Then we would hightail it back to the truck and get out of Dodge with a shiny suitcase full of money. Real simple. After what seemed like a very long time, I could see the running lights of a large vessel coming in from the east. The Bayou La Batrie boat had arrived. Ahead of me, I could hear John yell to the cabin cruiser. Two searchlights lit up and scanned the water. As soon as they found Big John's skiff, they started shooting. So much for the plan. I never saw John. I think he was in the water by then. Suddenly, searchlights lit up from everywhere. There had been three other boats that I hadn't seen. People were shooting all over the place. One boat had a heavy machine gun and was shooting tracers. These guys were shooting at the big shrimper. I know that Big John was still alive at this time because there was an explosion at the waterline of the cruiser. He at least still had a plan and was executing it. When two bullets hit my skiff, I decided it was time to move. I cranked up and pointed the boat toward the dark. I went a couple of hundred yards, looking back for that green flare, and cut the engine again, swinging around to watch the show. The cabin cruiser was settling in the water. The boat with the tracer rounds came closer, and people started jumping from the larger boat into it. The shooting continued. The shrimper started to burn. Probably the phosphorus tracers had caught it on fire. Once it started, it burned fast, and within a couple of minutes, there was a big whoomp of an explosion, and people covered in fire were jumping into the water. The shrimper sank within a minute of the explosion. The smoke from the shrimper's oil fire was mixing with the thickening fog. I was worried about being able to see the green flare as the visibility worsened, so I eased back in toward the battle. Two boats left, running full out. The last small boat on the scene stopped to pick up two people in the water, then it took off in the same direction. I could still hear sporadic gunfire in the distance. Later, I found out that the last boat was carrying members of the DEA Joint Interdiction Task Force. They had state cops from Mississippi and Louisiana, along with the DEA guys. It seems that I was the last person in two states to find out that there was a Bayou La Batrie shrimper hanging around Cat Island and doling out drugs. But there was still no flare. I putt-putted back toward the wreck of the big cruiser. Only the very top of the boat was still visible. I cut the engine and yelled for John. Someone answered from over where the shrimper went down. I cranked up again and eased over that way. The water was full of bodies. Some still, lying face down, some calling for help. I reached out and grabbed the first outstretched arm I came to. The man I pulled into the boat was Paolo, a Colombian who had some English. With my tiny bit of Spanish, we did okay. He was burned on one side of his face and his left arm, but he was in pretty good shape. As we picked up more people, it became evident how good a shape he was in. There were people with gunshot wounds, people with bad burns, and people with both. We worked our way around both boats in the sputtering light from the fires burning on top of the oil still welling up from the shrimper, the acrid fog thickening by the minute. We ended up with 11 men in our skiff. We left 5 men dead in the water. Big John Turner was nowhere to be found. It became evident that if we were going to get everybody back alive, we had to run for it. I pulled out the first aid kit that Big John had stowed in the skiff, and Paolo started working on the wounded like he had some experience. We also had 5 gallons of water and 2 pounds of turkey jerky. John had also packed a compass and laminated charts for the Rigolets and Lake Bourne. Of course, the charts didn't tell me where I was to start with. I grew up running boats, but the lakes and rivers around Catherine never prepared me to deal with this combination of fog, darkness, and general disorientation. I pointed the boat due north and ran for it. It was a plan, and it might have worked if someone hadn't left his log laying around. I had been running for almost an hour when we hit it. Sure felt like a big one when we hit it. I got pitched forward. Somehow, my face managed to hit the only 6 square inches in the whole boat that didn't have somebody's ass sitting on it. My glasses were smashed into my face. I broke my nose. Much worse, the outboard motor was dead. Paolo worked on it patiently while I tried to stop the blood that was pouring from my forehead and nose. All the good drugs in the first aid kit had been used long before I hit the injured reserve list. I made do with a fistful of generic ibuprofen. Rested my burning eyes for a minute, decided to doze for just a bit, and slipped off into deep sleep. I woke to the sound of a loud splash. It was Paolo, pitching the motor overboard. He was speaking Spanish very rapidly, but I got the gist of it. Of course, Big John had thought to put paddles in the boat. We had 3 of them. I sat in back and sculled with one while Paolo and whoever was feeling up to it at the time paddled. At dawn, 2 men were dead. The thick fog continued up until after 10 o'clock that morning. That was the best time in the boat. The men who could speak told stories about their dead friends, and Paolo translated for me as best he could. I passed my right-in-the-rain birding log around, and we got everyone's name, hometown, and contact addresses. We wrote down names of the men we knew were dead. I didn't put Big John on the list. I had convinced myself that he had been one of the 2 men the last boat had picked up. We told some more stories of our families, places we had been. Hard scrapes we'd come through. I was surprised that Paolo was the only Colombian. Our little boat was a tribute to the diversity of the Pan-American drug smuggling industry. We had a Cuban, 2 Venezuelans, 3 Mexicans, 1 Nicaraguan, and a Panamanian. No one knew where one of the dead guys was from. Somebody said that he talked like a Guatemalan. Everybody laughed. I guess Guatemalans have a funny accent. By noon, the fog had burned away, and a hot sun was sailing high above us. We had used 3 of our 5 gallons of water. Paolo was passing out all the pills in the first aid kit for pain, including Tums and Pepto-Bismol tablets. I reached for a water jug so Paolo could wet the cloth he was washing the faces of the men with. He looked back at me and gave his head a shake. He dipped the cloth into the salt water of Lake Bourne, saying, "Leche de la madre," mother's milk. I started to protest, but stopped when I saw his face. Paolo knew we might be in it for the long haul. That was sort of the end of the good times. Throughout the long, clear afternoon, we saw 3 planes high above us and heard 2 helicopters popping in the distance. We saw several boats on the horizon, zipping from out of the north, but none of them saw us. Actually, Paolo saw these things. Without my glasses, I was practically blind, and my face hurt so much when I put my binoculars to my eyes that I couldn't stand it. I gave the binoculars to Paolo and tried to content myself with living in a hot and fuzzy world. There's not much else to say about the boat. We paddled all that day, all night, and most of the next day. People died along the way. No one suggested throwing the bodies overboard. We laid them in the bow, slid them on their sides to save room. When I looked forward, I couldn't make out their faces. Nearly blind has its high points. We would come upon marsh islands every once in a while, and Paolo would get out of the boat and try to pull us along, but the mud was always too thick for him to get footing. Late on the second day, I was asleep when Paolo woke me, saying, "Un casa," a house. I took the binoculars from his hand and could see the West Rigolets lighthouse in the distance. The current flowing from the lake was strong, but when we pulled up close to marsh, Paolo was finally able to get some traction, and with a combination of my paddling and his pulling, we were able to make the lighthouse in about an hour. There were five of us still alive. Paolo and I carried the two sickest men and lay them in the shade of the lighthouse. I'll tell you, sitting down in that shade and finishing that last jug of water was the best sensation I have ever felt in my life. I pulled out my cell phone, figuring that I should surely be able to pick up a signal from that close to the highway. We could see the traffic right there in front of us. Dead battery. I had somehow turned it on during the ordeal, and it had bled out just like Alfonso Salba had. I helped Paolo gather some wood together for a bonfire, and set out to walk across the marsh to the highway. I knew that there had been a footpath and bridge out to the lighthouse, and figured that it couldn't be that bad. It was. An hour later, I had only gone what looked like a couple of hundred yards, and I was exhausted. I'd sat down in a clump of spartina to rest when I heard gunshots from back at the lighthouse. Someone had found them, and was signaling for me to return. I jumped up and slogged back the way I came, not wanting to literally miss the boat. Halfway there, I had to stop and catch my breath again. I decided that I might be close enough to call to Paolo if I could just stop panting. Then I heard shouting. I couldn't make out the words, but for some reason, I decided not to answer them. Then I heard Paolo yelling, "Fuga! Fuga! Correus! Fuga! Fuga!" I struggled with my high school Spanish, trying to remember what fuga meant. Yes, fuga meant run away. I knelt down in the mud right there where I was and pulled my gun out. I waited. I could actually hear him running through the marsh toward me when they shot him. Paolo Francisco Padilla. One hell of a man. I didn't go rushing out to avenge my friend. I hunkered down like a nutria rat and cried like a baby, scared as hell that the Vinnies or whoever the hell was out there would hear me sobbing and come shoot my miserable hide. It took me all night to walk out. I decided that to go to the highway might be the wrong thing to do. So I pushed east, walking some, swimming some, until I got to the little marina on the West Pearl at White Kitchen. I came up to the back of the place where there were two fishermen cleaning catfish they had caught during the night on their trot line. One of them looks up and sees me. He says, "I'll be damned twice over. You're that Speed fella from the TV. You're done lost at sea, son." The other guy who's got his back to me says, "Oh, hell, Simpson, that sucker's done dead and eat up by now." I didn't know which one to believe. Later that day, the St. Tammany Sheriff's Department went out to the lighthouse. No boat, no bodies, no blood, no muss, no bother. I turned to Narlene. "And that is my story, Rapunzel. Charming, isn't it?"
"So what did you tell the cops?"
"I told them the truth. That my friend, John Turner, had been working on a skip trace case, and that John had gotten a tip that his target, Alphonsus Anastasia Alba, would be on a cabin cruiser anchored at coordinates that John knew but that I did not. That he had asked for my help, and that when we got there all hell broke loose. That I lost track of John, but found 10 Hispanic men in the water with various ailments. I told them that my communications with these men had been badly hampered by ignorance of the Spanish language and their inability to speak English. That we drifted in an open boat for 2 days to finally land at the Rigolets. That I had gone for help. That I had heard shots from the direction of the lighthouse. And that I had not heard from nor seen John Turner since."
"How bad were you hurt, Jonathan?"
"Not bad. Broke nose, burnt to a crisp. Mosquito bit to hell and back, dehydrated. My face looked like hamburger. I don't know how in hell the guy at White Kitchen recognized me. I looked more like the Honey Island swamp monster than a Mississippi redneck at the time."
"And what happened to the list of names and addresses you took down on the boat?"
"Oh, those. I lost them, tromping through the swamp."
"Well, Jonathan, that's some story for sure. But you haven't told it very often, have you?"
"No, I haven't. Only to Vera, in fact. How'd you know?
It's just not as polished as the other JC Speed stories I've heard you tell. For one thing, it's obvious that you and Big John talked about Deeg a good deal, and I'm sure that you really know his name, right?
Right. That's perceptive of you, Rap.
So why don't you admit it?
Well, I never brought Deeg's name up when I was talking to the 5 or 6 governmental agencies that drugged me across the gravel for about a year. If he is still alive and with Big John, he may deserve my protection. Protecting him may protect Big John. Or, if he's still alive and he set up Big John, I don't want the law getting between him and me.
Vengeance is mine?
On this count, the Lord is going to have to stand in line. Now, Arlene, if you ever breathe a word of this to Vera, I'm going to hunt you down as soon as I'm able to walk again. Hear me?
Yeah. One more thing. I have a hard time believing that you and Big John had a suitcase full of money and didn't take at least a little bit out before you took off for the big meet.
Well, I did tuck a few hundreds in my pocket, but we just didn't have any place to hide anymore in the short time we had.
I see. Jonathan, what happened to Big John's truck?
It's sitting in the garage behind my house, waiting for Big John to come back.
It wouldn't have one of those safe boxes like your van, would it?
No, I'm sure it doesn't. Too bad, huh? If I'd been in my van, I could be rich.
Yeah, too bad. I've got just one more question. Do you know Jorge Padilla, who's in my geography class at school?
No, I don't think I do. What a coincidence.
Yeah, I think he's from Colombia, too. You should get in touch with him.
I'll be sure to do that.
You know, he told me that he was here on a special UMAC scholarship for Latin American students. I had never heard of it before, but he says there are 2 other people on the same scholarship.
Really?
Really. And I was surprised to find out that Jorge's Latin American scholarship comes from the same foundation that gave Gojo his scholarship, the Turner Trust.
See, I told you that I shouldn't tell you this story. Now you're looking for conspiracies under every rock. Do I look like a man with a suitcase full of money? Did you ever know a rich man who had to work at a mini-mart?
No, Jonathan. But Goat doesn't live in a big fancy house, and he's gonna end up working day and night in this bar he's building. Anyway, it's already been well established that you are weird and crazy to boot.
Speaking of Goat, we need to get on the road before he starts climbing the walls.
Okay, I'm ready.
When we got back to the van, Narlene said,
I know what you said about not being able to tell people what they call you, and I can see that. But, Jonathan, I really like it when you call me Rap.
Sure thing, Susie. Buckle up. That girl can sure hit hard for a Miss Hospitality.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at DancingCatStudios.com. The information concerning the Battle of New Orleans found at the beginning of this episode is licensed under the GNU Free Documentation License. It uses material from the Wikipedia article, The Battle of New Orleans. Complete links are in our show notes.